Hello and welcome to another Innovation Forum podcast with me, Toby Wamp. And joining me in this podcast is Eric Mayard from Borneo Futures. So welcome to the podcast, Eric. How are you?
Thank you, Toby. Very well. Long day of talking about palm oil, but all very good.
We're here at the RSPO conference in Paris, so you can hear the odd banging of doors in the background, listeners. And Eric, you've been launching a new report you've just done on palm oil and biodiversity. So yeah. Tell us about that.
It comes from the ICN mandate that was given out in 2016. The ICN, International Union of Conservation of Nature, decided that they knew too little about palm oil, or at least the members of the ICN. So they commissioned the establishment of a task force, which I chair, the Oil Palm Task Force, as well as the development of the report you just mentioned on oil palm and biodiversity. As any of these things, it's complex. It's not straightforward. Palm oil is one of these topics where everyone has a very clear understanding, they think, of what is going on. And people very much hate palm oil for certain reason. For instance, the disappearance of orangutans, or people love palm oil because it's great for their income.
Yeah, I mean, there's palm oil, then palm oil, you know. And in the last podcast that I did earlier this week with Josh Lyons-White from Imperial, he was pointing out that there's a fair bit of palm oil that's always been grown on degraded land, or land that was never used for forests in living memory.
Yeah.
So it's not as simple as palm oil bad.
And no, and I keep telling people, like, if I was an oil palm tree, I'd be pretty damn pissed off, because it's just a tree. It's just a tree that happens to produce a lot of oil. But I've never quite understood why people hate palm oil with a vengeance and they love coconuts. You look at coconuts, I mean, there's about 25 million hectares of oil palm in the world. There's about 14 million hectares of coconut palms. And one is evil and the other one is good. Well, doesn't quite add up that way. Of course, coconut has displaced a lot of forests as well and has biodiversity problem. Yeah. We just don't look at it.
Yeah, well, bananas, famously, you know, if right. You want to start a banana plantation, well, the first thing you do is engage in enormous deforestation.
Exactly, yeah. But they taste good. We don't care.
Yeah. And, you know, now they didn't develop in an era of social media with, you know, big-eyed animals and very clever NGOs.
Yeah.
You know, who are very good at raising awareness.
Yeah, I think palm oil has always been associated from the 1990s with orangutan conservation. I think that juxtaposition of a new crop coming into Asia and this lovely furry orangutan that's been certainly threatened by palm oil, I think has always put palm oil in a certain special place compared to some of the other commodities that also produce oil, soy and maize and rapeseed and so on.
Yeah, but now, having said just now that palm oil is getting perhaps slightly rough deal compared to other commodities, the words palm oil and biodiversity don't always go together, given that you are talking about a monoculture, as in many other agriculture.
Yeah.
So what is happening there in terms of improving the biodiversity in and around palm oil plantations in your experience?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty obvious that if you have a tropical rainforest, a piece of tropical rainforest full of its species, it's very high biodiversity, and you cut that down and you put a monoculture in instead, your biodiversity is going to go down. There's no doubt about that. Crops get developed on degraded land, and that becomes quite a different story then. And quite often, I think we see oil palm in its business as usual context. That basically means people cut down a piece of rainforest or plant oil palm, and they don't worry about biodiversity, they don't worry about species. But there are some really good examples where oil palm plantations have been really well managed, where hunting has been fully controlled, where there's zero snaring, and you would actually be surprised how much biodiversity comes back. It's never going to be a tropical rainforest, but compared to, and I think that comparison is relevant, compared to some of the other oil-producing vegetable crops, like soy and maize and so on, they're all annual crops. You plant them, you harvest them, and you cut them down, and you got bare soil left. There is very little biodiversity compared to an oil palm plantation that stands there for 25 years. People are harvesting it, and then it gets replaced. Especially if that happens in a matrix of forest set-asides and forest corridors and so on, I think we can actually maintain a decent level of biodiversity. And again, coming back to the orangutan, it's a really good example, because like in Borneo, 75% of orangutans live outside the protected area network. So 25% we can actually manage as a protected species in a protected area. 75% of the orangutans are going to somehow have to manage to survive in this matrix of smallholder agriculture, oil palm, pulp and paper, you name it, rubber, everything is there. And that's where the big challenges are. And oil palm isn't the only player, there's many other players, but we somehow need to learn how wildlife and people can learn to rub shoulders and wildlife surviving in that rubbing process.
And where are the best examples of that emerging? I mean, you know, you as a scientist, as a conservationist, have lived out there for years looking at all these different projects. where are the examples of best practice of that happening?
Interestingly enough, I don't think there's so much happening in Southeast Asia. I think there's some excellent examples in Brazil where companies have been very tightly managed and where biodiversity is really bouncing back. Gabon in Africa, I think there's some good examples there. I've worked with a company in Indonesian Borneo for quite a few years now, and they involved me slightly too late, but I was there early enough to start talking to management about plantation design, set-asides. They're setting aside about 30% of the plantation. And we've got 150 orangutans in those set-asides within the plantation that are actually really well managed. And that's quite often sometimes people forget. They think, well, just leave the forest, leave the orangutans, but that doesn't mean they're safe. I mean, they're still going to be hunted, and there's still people going into these forests. So I always look at management. An idea, ideally for conservation, it's a protected area that gets managed, but that's not always what we get. Then a timber concession would be really good. A really well-managed timber concession can be really great for conservation. But even some of the monocultures, oil palm, pulp and paper and so on, if they're well-managed for biodiversity, I think we'd actually be surprised how much can actually survive there. And it has to be part of the equation.
Mm. And what do you see as the role of groups like RSPO going forward to encourage this kind of approach and spread best practice? And what do you hope that will be the results of the report that you've put out today for organisations like RSPO?
The RSPO, I think, plays an important role. They're the kind of key independent process of verification and evaluation of certain jointly agreed principles and criteria of managing palm oil concessions and planning landscapes for palm oil concessions. So they're playing an important role. We've done some studies, and I think at the moment it's still quite clear that RSPO certification compared to non-certification has at best marginal benefits. But I think that's partly because little time has been available to develop these practices. It takes a long time. I can talk to a boardroom in a company and convince people that this is the right thing to do. It's quite something else to actually get that translated on the ground with people that are actually doing the work that decide whether they are or they're not going to cut down a tree or kill an orangutan or not kill an orangutan. And that's where a lot of work needs to be done to build up that capacity and get people to understand what does it actually mean to manage a biodiversity friendly oil palm concession.
And what's the role of the big companies in that? Because it's protecting forests, as you say, is one thing, but if they're not managed and there isn't that micro interventions on the ground, you know, it could all be for nothing. So NGOs have criticized companies for failing to fund implementation of their own policies. We've seen that in the lead up to 2020 and the deforestation targets.
Yeah.
In your particular area, what would you like to see more of from the companies in terms of how they fund conservation?
How to fund conservation? I think they can be the trendsetters if they choose to be, because quite often they have the financial means that smaller companies won't have. So they can develop the pilots where we really demonstrate what well-managed oil palm can actually look like and what biodiversity benefits it can have. I mean, there's opportunities to offset impacts through compensatory mechanisms and so on. All of that is really in its very early stages. So how that's going to pan out, I don't know. I'd like to see the big companies to go beyond the talk and actually do something meaningful on the ground that makes a difference. And I think not everyone is in there yet. So yeah, we need to push harder and make sure that's what they're doing, because if it isn't for the big companies to make those changes, the small companies are certainly not going to follow.
Well, every company in agriculture dealing with tropical agriculture, it seems to me, has their lovely pet project of smiling smallholder farmers who they seem happy to empower and work with and put in their reports.
Right, yeah.
Why don't we see more of that with biodiversity, I suppose, is the question, right?
Explain that a little bit better.
I mean, in terms of investing more in biodiversity projects and then making more out of it.
Yeah, so they are doing that, but the examples I've seen on the ground, they're just not doing it well enough. It's quite often RSPO certification requires the identification of high conservation value forest areas. It's one thing to identify them and set them aside so you don't develop them. It's quite another thing to manage them optimally. So there really is zero impact on biodiversity. There's no hunting, there's no snaring, there's no fire, there's no illegal logging. That's where I think a lot of the companies could be doing a lot better and should be doing a lot better.
Okay, well, there's a challenge for business listening. And listeners, if you want to know more about this sort of thing, we are holding our Landscapes Conference on the 6th and 7th of November in London. I hope you can join us there. We'll be discussing this issue and many others at the conference. And meanwhile, Eric, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.